Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This podcast exists because of the fine folks at patreon.com/DaveChen. Head on over to patreon.com/DaveChen to help support podcasts like Decoding Westworld and get exclusive bonus content that me and Siddhanth record separately for those folks at the $10 plus tier. Again, that's patreon.com/DaveChen. Thanks to everyone who's supporting the podcast.
You were as close to a god as a man gets. You and your associates created a world and ruled it absolutely, controlled our every move. And now, I'm going to do the same to you. What's that you used to say? Winning doesn't mean anything unless someone loses. You're just here to be the loser.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Westworld. I am David Chen.
I'm Siddhant Adlakha.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. What we do on this show, which is available at decodingwestworld.com, it's also available on YouTube on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/DaveChensky, is we will discuss, spoil, speculate about every week's episode of Westworld immediately after it airs. We're not going to bring in stuff from future episodes that includes stuff from the next time on preview. We're going to keep it focused on this episode. You can always email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. So this week we're going to be discussing season 4, episode 2, Well Enough Alone. And Siddhanth, let's start by just talking about overall thoughts on this episode. I like to just kind of chat about overall thoughts and, yeah, just your initial reaction.
Phew, I'm relieved. It was simple. It was I mean, for Westworld standards, it was straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we're going to be, you know, pulling our hair out trying to, you know, detangle too many things that weren't already tangled, you know, in the previous week. So if anything, it clarifies a few things.
I agree. I think there were a handful of really cool sequences in this episode. I think there's a lot of setup. This felt like a very transitionary episode. Some questions have been answered, but there are many more big pressing questions that have not been answered. And of course, as with any Westworld episode, it raises a bunch of new questions. So I thought this was a fine, good episode. You know, nothing earth-shattering, but not certainly not bad or frustrating in any way. Just like a pretty standard transition, middle-of-the-season episode for Westworld, I thought. So. Yeah, so let's get into it. Before we do that, I do want to call out, it is 100 degrees where Siddhanth is today. So you might hear some air conditioning noise in the background. If so, that's because I don't want Siddhanth to be melting while he's recording the podcast with me. So just so you know, if you hear that in the background, that's what's going on. All right, let's get to it. This episode opens with Clementine at some kind of market. You pegged it in Latin America, right?
I couldn't quite figure out where, but they were speaking Spanish, and there was a sign for people selling tacos. So could be Mexico, could be somewhere in South America. I'm not entirely sure.
Clementine's there. All of a sudden, William / Man in Black shows up, and he wants to know where Maeve is. And it's not even really a fight scene. He just straight up murders her because she won't tell him.
Mm-hmm.
Brutal opening scene, almost felt like a parody of this kind of scene to some degree, like where like Clementine's like having a beautiful life. Like, have you seen MacGruber, for instance, the Will Forte movie?
Yes, I have.
Incredible movie. And at the beginning of that movie, like Will Forte is like living amongst the people in a rural area, you know, and like he's like, I left that whole life behind me. And that's what I felt like Clementine was in this scenario, only the man in black shows up dressed up as his character from Westworld. And he's not going to let Clementine leave her life behind. So let's start with some basic factual questions, Siddhanth, which is assuming this is the Clementine host body that used to be in the park, can you give us some details about what has happened to Clementine's host body in the past?
Sure. So Clementine is one of the oldest hosts in Westworld. And we know this because she was around when young William, played by Jimmy Simpson, was visiting the park for the first time. And, you know, she was there throughout the decades. She was one of the sex workers in Maeve's brothel. And then at one point, when it seems like, you know, her and Maeve are kind of questioning their reality and catching on to what's happening, she is replaced by another host body who also goes by the name Clementine. And we'll get to who that is later in the episode.
Yeah. New Clementine, she is often referred to. Yeah.
New Clementine. This is original or old Clementine. And then, you know, she shows up again in the, I suppose you would call it the backstage area of Westworld throughout season one. She's featured somewhat prominently in season two, where she is infected with and helps spread this malicious code that keeps making the hosts kill each other.
Yes. In a rather badass fashion, you know, she did that.
Yeah. Riding on a
riding
horse.
It was really cool. Yeah.
Yeah, horses are big this week. And then somehow, you know, she gets out of Westworld and we see her show up once in season three, where she comes face to face with Musashi Dolores. Do we have a nickname for this version of Dolores yet?
Musaurus?
That's fine by me.
Musaurus?
It sounds, the first one sounds suitably Jurassic World enough in keeping with the whole Crichton theme. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we see her once, we see her get shot. But then I think she escapes because somebody else attacks Musaurus. But also, I think she like dies and is resurrected like twice during season two anyway. Because as we discussed in previous episodes, you know, death doesn't really matter all that much for the hosts anymore. Yeah. But yeah, and now she's shown up in season four and is killed yet again. It seems to be kind of, you know, her thing. You know, just dying and being brought back to life.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so she got out of the park in season three and then presumably like escaped after the riots, like escaped kind of live a life of solitude.
Yeah.
And didn't expect that William would ever find her.
And just when she thought she was out, they pulled her back in.
Yeah. And I talked about Clementine's like body because I wasn't trying to be, you know, grotesque in any way, or crass in any way. Because in Westworld, basically, it can be like Charlotte Hale's body and then Dolores's mind. As far as we know, it's actually Clementine's mind in Clementine's body, at least in the opening scene, right?
We have to assume, I think.
I think that's right. Yeah.
The thing is, the episode doesn't give us any reason to believe otherwise, but also, as I've been saying, this is Westworld we're talking about, so anything's possible.
Later on, you see Clementine has apparently become like a receptionist.
Yeah.
Receptionist assassin at Delos. Is it the same Clementine body that we saw in the opening scene of this episode, or is it like a new Clementine replica that has like been reprogrammed? Unclear, right? I don't know if we have any...
Unclear, but my assumption, just because we, you know, see William, you know, quote unquote, kill her in the opening scene, is that this version of Clementine has been reprogrammed somehow and is working for him. Because reprogramming is another thing that, you know, comes up in a multitude of ways during this episode.
Yeah. So I think what we should do is there's not that many plot lines in this episode. Let's talk about the Christina stuff first.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's talk about the Caleb and Maeve stuff, which kind of is the rest of the episode. It all kind of ties into Caleb, Maeve, and William. Those plots are all related. So the Christina stuff is kind of on her own this episode, and there's only a few major developments. First of all, she kind of wakes up again in her house. We see that she's been slashed in the arm. So like it was in fact real what happened to her. Like she didn't imagine it or anything. And then she is really shaken by the fact that this guy offed himself. And she talks to her roommate, Maya. Like, all that Maya has done is basically tried to downplay Christina's concerns this entire season so far. He's like, yeah, it's not a big, whatever. The guy was out of his mind and don't worry about it. Maybe his will wasn't updated. You know, like she's just trying to like play off her concerns, you know, and she remembers that, hey, I think I wrote a plot line that was like this guy. And then all of a sudden the guy shows up and it's like the plot line from the thing I wrote. And so she goes to work, but then she notices some dead birds as a bad omen. And she's like, okay, I got to go figure out this guy's foundation that he left all this money to. Let me pause there. You know, I'm kind of skimming over a lot of it. I'm curious if you had any reaction to these opening segments of Christina's storyline this week.
I did, but let me first mention that before she sees the dead birds, she stops to talk to or listen to this ranting homeless man on the High Line who we briefly saw last week. And he doesn't seem to make eye contact with her. I don't know if he's entirely in his senses or if he doesn't notice her. No, it doesn't look like anything to me. But he does talk about, you know, hearing some kind of signals or something. And he mentions this tower and we see the sketch of this tower. And he also mentions, you know, something about birds, which maybe that's why Christina takes notice of these birds. It's weird that nobody else seems to notice them, or maybe they just don't care. So obviously there's a lot of weird stuff going on that she is starting to kind of pick up on.
Right. There's something, she's questioning the nature of her reality. There's something obviously not right with the weirdness that's going on around her. And maybe some things are lining up a little bit too quickly or too easily for them to all just be coincidences. I will say, here's what does feel very real world, Siddhanth, is her boss knowing exactly where her whereabouts are and giving her a hard time for like not showing up to work that day. That feels very true to life, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
He's like, so I notice you're accessing your files and you're doing it from New Jersey. Like, what's going on with that? You know, her excuse has fallen apart very rapidly, unfortunately. So
relatable protagonist.
Indeed, indeed. Okay, so anything else that happens with Christina's storyline? I mean, it's a very Twilight Zone-esque storyline, mm-hmm. right? Where she shows up to the thing and then the place where he left all the money is seems like completely abandoned, but there's still people there doing stuff. I think we're probably, and then she sees like all these ominous drawings of the tower there as well.
Yeah.
Whatever that, or a tower. Maybe it's a separate one, but it's like she sees all the drawings of a tower. It feels like we're maybe like 1 to 2 episodes away from finding out what exactly is going on with this version of Christina.
Like,
go ahead. Yeah.
And I think, you know, like you said, this introduces more questions than it answers, but I think it does it in a really fascinating way because we find out that this whole thing of, you know, her potentially writing someone else's story or informing someone else's, you know, story / real life is more winding and complicated than we thought, because there was already a person by this name who already died, who may have also left money to the same place. So what is really informing what? Did a real event somehow make its way into her subconscious and then re-manifest as something else, which then affected this Peter person? Where does this begin, this story, this information loop?
Right.
Where does it end? Where does it begin? And I think even though we may not be stuck in a literal loop like the characters were in season one, it's starting to feel like we are in a very, like, you know, out there kind of way. Like, where's the beginning? Where's the end? What is going on? But what I also like this time, whenever we see Christina, whether it's in her apartment and, you know, the way she shot through a mirror, like a narrow mirror that kind of closes in on her, or when we see her walking into the mental health facility, she's shot from a distance from behind glass, like she's being watched. And as if this is, you know, the point of view of some kind of stalker. And I don't know if it's meant to, you know, embody a literal person, but it's definitely meant to make us feel a little weird that we are peering in on this woman's life in a way that she can't fully recognize, but is somewhat aware of.
Do you agree at this point that what we're seeing with Christina is not base reality, or like it's not taking place in the same reality or timeline as the other storylines? Do you agree with that at this point, or Where are you landing on that?
I don't know how to answer that.
You're not landing anywhere yet. Yeah.
No, I still have, like, it could be. It could be taking place like 100 years in the past, 100 years in the future. I think I've seen some theories floating around on Reddit that, you know, this part of the story is actually an adaptation of Future World, the sequel to the original Westworld movie. But to that, I would say, well, I mean, there's no difference for us as viewers because the rest of the show already takes place in the future. So,
yeah. But, well, yeah, you say that, but then we also got like a, 1920s or 30s-esque world this episode, which is like, is that really that different than Westworld? You know?
That's true. That's
true. But I think, let me tell you, Siddhanth, I think we're definitely not in the same reality. And I'm going to use a very unconventional piece of evidence for that, which is when she calls her roommate Maya from from the wing of the hospital. There is a shot of Maya sitting on a park bench in a park with like it's you see her from the back. And you see like all these trees around her. It's one of the most beautiful shots that's ever been on Westworld. And it looks incredible, but it also looks extremely dreamlike and weird.
Okay.
And it's just like, why would they use such a weird, like a normal show, quote unquote, normal show would have like a pedestrian phone call interaction like that happen with like a very standard, almost like shot reverse shot kind of, coverage, right? But the fact that they use this like very ethereal, weird shot of her from behind makes me think there's something off about this world. I know I'm really stretching, but it did stick out to me. I was watching, I was like, what a weird shot that one is, you know? Anyway.
I don't think you're stretching because now that you mention it, yeah, that is a strange decision.
Yeah. Like, why wouldn't they just show her like straight on sitting on the park bench? Like, why would they make this like really weird ass version of that shot from behind? It just is weird. Anyway, but it's beautiful. It is strikingly beautiful. This shot of Ariana DeBose as Maya sitting on a park bench from behind, and you see like all these trees and light pouring through them. It's incredible. So,
and look, at this point, the creators know that we're going to be questioning every decision. So maybe they're just messing with you. Who knows?
Totally.
But also another thing that happens in that same scene is when Christina sees what looks to be, you know, construction workers in, you know, a nearby hallway, she freezes and she says, just leave. And they walk away. Mm-hmm. And that could be one of two things. That could just be a hopeful coincidence. Or, as we've already been, you know, theorizing because of all the Peter stuff, does she have some kind of influence on the people around her? Are these even people? Is what we're seeing a real world? Is it a simulation that she is somehow, you know, influencing? And I think, again, that's, you know, it's the purpose of, you know, a scene or an interaction like that is to make us and make Christina, you know, question the nature of our reality.
Yeah. I am sticking with the interpretation I floated last week, which is that what we're seeing is in the sublime somehow. This is some relic element or artifact of Dolores's personality that's architecting narratives so that all the hosts are able to survive and not degrade. That's my story. I'm sticking with it. We'll see what happens.
Let's stick with your theory for a second and go back to those three bros we saw getting off the High Line. Are human beings now visiting the sublime? Because I'm taking your theory seriously here.
Like,
we got into a stage where, you know, guests are now not entering a physical world like Westworld, but a virtual world like the sublime.
It's not outside their own possibility. I don't think that's happening. As I said last week, none of these theories really account for everything. Yeah. Here's my question though, Siddhanth, is what exactly was said by those dude bros, right? Because I think they said something like, it's your first time here, is it, right? Is that what they said? Or
something like that. Like, they were, you know, kind of praising whatever experience this was. Oh, that was so cool. And one of them definitely says, I can't believe it's your first time here. And then another says something like, come on, I want to show you something cool or something like that.
Yeah, I guess it felt vague enough to me that it didn't, you know, maybe that's memories that the hosts have of of visitors to the park manifesting themselves in this narrative somehow, you know? Maybe.
Okay. You okay. You know, I feel
just,
like if we
just came up with that, I extemporized that, Siddhant, you know? Maybe.
If we throw out enough of these, we'll eventually land on some combination that'll end up being true.
If there's a infinite monkeys on infinite typewriters, eventually we will figure out what the plot of Westworld this season is. So,
oh God, we're the monkeys, aren't we?
Yes, indeed. Anyway, I like this. It, taken by itself, the Christina storyline is like a cool little Twilight Zone-esque episode, right? It's like,
oh yeah,
oh, she goes to the, and I like the way you put it of who is creating what? What is the originator of the story that's then feeding back into the reality? Like, it feels like an Ouroboros, like snake eating itself, yeah, kind of deal, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that it's disorienting in that way. So I appreciate it. We should, of course, point out, I don't think we saw Teddy at any point in this episode.
Oh, we didn't.
So no James Marsden, no Teddy, which is very frustrating because I am kind of legit frustrated when that happens, when it's like at the end of last episode, we tease a thing and then you're like, okay, I can't wait to see the thing. And then you watch the episode and then the thing doesn't show up.
You'll see him in season 5. It's fine.
I think he'll be back like next episode or the episode after, but not yet. Any other thoughts on the Christina storyline this episode?
I think it leaves off in an interesting place with her, you know, seeing the tower sketches on the wall of this facility. And also Maya kind of being on her side a little bit,
mm-hmm,
you know, kind of assuring her that she's not insane.
Mm-hmm.
Which then made me question, wait, is she, you know, in on whatever this is, aware of whatever this is? Or is she just a good friend and roommate?
Right, right. Is she the opposite, right? Which is she trying to subvert or sabotage Christina in any way?
Or is she trying to help her? It could be any of these things.
Indeed. All right. Before we move to the other plot lines, let's take a quick break and talk about what else you're working on these days, Siddhant.
Sure. So for Vulture's Streamliner vertical, which is all about the streaming age, I recently wrote a guide to Zee5, that's Zee5, which is an Indian streaming service that made its way to the United States last June. And the reason there's been some interest in it here is because it's where you can find the Telugu language blockbuster RRR in its original Telugu language, because on Netflix it's only in Hindi. And I thought, you know, if people are going to sign up, I may as well tell them a little more about the app and give them some more recommendations, because there's a whole host of stuff out there in various languages.
Cool. Well, you can find that at Vulture. I want to give a shout out to the folks over at, tell them to go check out my podcast, Culturally Relevant, at culturallyrelevantshow.com. It's my semi-weekly or bi-weekly interview podcast where I talk to a variety of different writers, actors, and journalists about stuff that's happening in our culture and society. So check that out at Culturally Relevant. Okay, let's get to the rest of the episode.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot of Caleb and Maeve this episode. It's a very Caleb and Maeve heavy episode. Before we leave that opening scene, though, with William just slitting Clementine's throat, we all observed that William showed up in his Man in Black full getup in that scene. The dude is basically like a LARPer. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, he's basically like he's a LARPer. Like he goes and plays Man in Black in the Westworld Park, and then he like likes to be that person in reality. And we see him with the full getup when he assassinates Clementine, but also when he's like playing golf with, I think, the vice president, is it?
Oh, yeah.
So just anytime you see Willem, he's a LARPer. That's all I'm going to say. And it's, I don't know if this show is pro or anti LARPing culture quite yet, but it's undeniable. It's undeniable that he's LARPing. Okay.
Well, every LARPer dies like a bunch of times. So who knows?
Indeed. We see Caleb and Maeve drive to this senator's house. A little bit of Westworld, classic Westworld hand wavy stuff. Like, how did they know about the senator and what the senator's role is? I think Maeve just straight up like introduces that idea at the end of the last episode without real any fanfare, if I recall correctly, right?
Yeah, I think we're led to assume that she figured it out by getting into Colonel Brigham's memories when she cut his head off.
There you go. Okay, yeah, no, great call out. And you know, she. So they go and see the senator. They realize that they're hosts. And then a fight scene ensues where, you know, Caleb's arm's dislocated and Maeve stabs people to death and then shuts down the senator. And it's all like actually really cool. Like, it's a pretty cool, well done scene. Maeve is unable to shut down the other hosts using her force powers because these are better models. But she was able to do it eventually. Whatever, you know.
She covertly downloaded an update.
This is the, unplug it and plug it back in style of technology explanation. Like, yeah, she didn't work when she tried it the first 18 times, but then she tried it the 19th time, and then that's when it froze him. But not before they could have a really cool action scene.
Yeah.
I think it was a really cool action scene with decent camera movements. And it's cool that, like, Anastasia... like does a lot of the fight scene wearing what appears to be like a sort of formal dress, which is just very difficult to do a fight scene in. Like, I always admire whenever they're able, because it's like you can't like put any padding or anything like that under there. Like, from a stunt perspective, it's very hard to do. And then she like Maeve interfaces with Anastasia and then like finds out what happened to the original senator and his wife. Now, before we get to that, any thoughts on like this entire sequence?
It begins with them just driving and exchanging banter. And this is the most unexpected dynamic because, again, I think they met maybe once last season towards the very end.
Yeah, and in now, the final episode, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I just want Caleb and Maeve scene.
Yes.
There's
a great line where, he's talking about his wife and kid and, she says like they're the best thing that ever happened to me, and she says something like, well, to be fair, it was a really low bar before. It's really amazing line that she says. To be fair, that bar was rather low considering the life that you lived prior. That's the line that she says. It's just like, wow, extremely dry and brutal, and I love that. But yeah, I think they have a great dynamic. I'm enjoying it.
And then when they finally figure out that the senator and his wife are hosts, or rather, Maeve, I guess, springs the information on us by shooting one of them. And you're totally in Caleb's shoes, like, wait, what are we here to do? What's happening? Because I'm assuming, she senses it with her,
with her force powers.
We got to figure out a word for it. Yeah. Midichlorians, I guess.
Yeah.
But I like that the senator and his wife are just acting so normal and in character. Because clearly they're meant to, they're meant to blend in. They're meant to fool people.
Yeah.
And I like what the host version of the senator says when Maeve makes him reveal his base code. He claims to be an emissary of a new world order.
Yeah.
And that is so sinister.
Yeah, and there's 249 others like him, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
So these are the hosts that Charlotte Hale, or Charloris, was building at the end of last season, right? Like, at the end of post-credits scene last season, she reveals she has, like, all these host-making machines, and presumably she's building these 249 things. But I like how his regular response is like, I'm Congressman blah 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 from the district of blah blah, and then she says base code only, and he's like, I'm an emissary of the new world order. And it's like, wow, that's a big big difference there.
How do we know that wasn't in character? How do we know this you know, Senator isn't part of like some cult as well.
It's true. Also, I think I don't remember when it's covered in the episode, but we do find out that the thing we saw last episode was actually a flashback.
Yes.
That she and Caleb actually have been on some adventures. Maeve and Caleb have been on some adventures, and that he almost died, but he survived. So, like, yeah, it looked like he died in that brief little clip. And probably, my guess is we're probably going to see more of the flashback or whatever later this season. I don't know. But anyway, so that was a real thing that actually happened, basically. I just wanted to, it was a mystery from last episode. I wanted to mention that that is discussed. But
yes, they discuss it later in the episode. But just, again, I just want a supercut of all their scenes together because they're so good. So good.
Yeah, they have great chemistry. So then there's a flashback and you see how like William replaced the congressperson and his wife with hosts, and Charloris was there, and she says something like, we got to experiment. I need help researching a new experiment. Take her to the barn with the rest of the livestock. So like, we now, I think, understand that the hosts fly, like mind control flies, are some kind of like they're not a fully tested technology yet. And I think it makes sense, narratively speaking, that they're not fully tested, because if they could fully mind control, there would be no need for hosts, right? There would no need to like replicate humans as host bodies and have them like replace the humans, because if you can control people's minds, you don't need to do that.
And I think she kind of says something to that effect. She does. I'm getting ahead of myself, but later in the episode, she does kind of, you know, comment on the two different things.
Right.
But coming back to this flashback that we were talking about, I'm really enjoying it as a narrative device. When Maeve is able to experience someone else's memories, it makes it very narratively convenient for us to then, you know, jump from one character or one timeline into another one without it feeling at random. Because even though the flashback is presented from sort of a neutral perspective, you know, she's seeing what, you know, theoretically, excuse me, she's seeing what, I was so excited that I'm just whacking the table.
I love it.
She's,
yeah.
She's seeing,
she's experiencing what, it subjectively, right? Yeah.
Yes, experiencing it subjectively from the host senator's point of view, even though the host senator is not in the room when the scene begins. So that's one thing you just kind of have to accept, you know, that happens, that we're seeing it from, we are seeing it from a more neutral perspective. It's a great scene. It's really eerie when the senator and his wife, you know, see these doppelgangers of themselves walk in, kind of the same way William did at the end of last season.
It's like, you know, the T-1000 in Terminator 2. Like, when you see a robot that looks like yourself, you are in deep trouble, basically.
Yeah.
So
I actually want to point out something that Vulture's TV critic Roxana Haddadi pointed out about this episode. She was wondering if you know, all these replicated hosts just have an entire wardrobe of the people they're replicating, and then, you know, they, you know, wear whatever they're wearing in that particular scene and then stroll in.
I think my guess is they're like, oh, we got to get the wardrobe right for the entry, so like, yeah, for maximum dramatic impact. But it's just for the meet and greet. Once that's done, then they can just use the actual wardrobe of the humans, right? So. But yes, it raises all sorts of questions about how this replacement process actually works. I agree. And also the way that those flashbacks happen is always like really cool. There's usually like a flashing black, and then sometimes it'll like smash cut black back to Maeve afterwards. And that's really cool as well. The way it like cuts between the flashbacks and her like tuning into them, I think is really well done. So
when it cuts back to her this time, her reaction is so funny. Just the dry delivery of, oh, well, it's actually worse than I thought.
Yeah.
I'm with you, Maeve. I'm with you.
So they go to the barn to find Anastasia Prime, right? And she has killed all the horses. Like, there's blood everywhere. There's dead horses everywhere. And Anastasia is in a really terrible state. She starts talking about opening night of Don Giovanni, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a Mozart opera. And she says, you know, I've done my part. Now it's time to do yours. And she like attacks Caleb. Maeve straight up shoots Anastasia in the head in a moment that I thought was almost comical, because it's like Maeve's like, yep, there's no saving her now. Whatever if she was human before, she's definitely not human now. It's like, Maeve, you don't know that. You don't know that, Maeve. Like, you it's not worth taking a chance that maybe you can bring her back, you know?
To be fair, Maeve has a sense of when someone is robot. So maybe she sensed robot flies in her.
Yeah, but like, maybe it's reversible, dude. Like, it just reminds me, it's like somebody who like accidentally kills an innocent bystander in an action movie, and they're like, oh, they were starting to turn into a zombie. Didn't you see? Like, it was and it's like, dude, you don't even know. We literally don't even know what's going on. Maybe you don't need to murder them quite yet, you know? I think if this season, I love what this season is doing with the flies and making the flies into this like kind of monstrous thing, right? Like,
yeah,
like a horror villain, basically. Like, these flies are kind of a horror villain. If there was none of the other sci-fi stuff and William and Robot Uprising stuff, and this episode was this season was just about the flies as a villain, that would actually, I don't know that that would be more interesting than what the show is, but it's like that's enough to almost sustain it, like certainly several episodes of a show is the way they're conceptualizing the flies and the way that they're executed, you know, how you see them, how they show up, I think is just really cool, creepy, and well done this season. What do you think?
No, completely. And it also brings up some really eerie implications. Just when, you know, the barn scene begins, what went through my head is, okay, at this point, what is the difference between the real Anastasia and the host Anastasia, if they are both, you know, identical and also have been programmed or reprogrammed for very specific purposes? You know, and obviously there's a, you know, to a degree, a physiological difference. One is literal flesh and blood and one is meant to impersonate it. But from the standpoint of, you know, being controlled or the space they occupy conceptually as the senator's wife, what is the difference between them if they can both be so easily programmed and controlled? And that's a scary thought. And even scarier is the fact that once, this human Anastasia delivers this message, this invitation to Maeve and Caleb, she says something to the effect of, you know, needing to be freed or put out of her misery. And so what I'm wondering is, wait, was she programmed to attack Maeve and Caleb for the express purpose of them killing her? Like, was that part of the plan? Like, making these other characters kill her? And if so, damn, Charloris is cold.
Indeed. I think the big difference, right, so far as we can tell, is the fly-controlled humans can't really pass themselves off as the former human person.
Yes.
They're not convincingly a replica of the human person, at least not for extended periods of time. Which raises the question, Siddhanth, who is worthy of being taken over by flies versus who is worthy of being replaced by human host, right? Apparently there's a hierarchy, and I'm just going to say if robots are going to take over the world, I'd rather be one of the people that it was worth the trouble of making a robot version of me for, you know, don't take over my brain with flies. Like, if I have flies going in my nose, you know that my life has gone wrong somewhere, basically. I want them to slaughter me and then also replace me completely with a robot. That's kind of my preference.
Well, look, because you say nose, but you see what happens later in the episode.
It goes in the guy's eye.
Worse.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I'd rather have a fly in my nose than in my eye. I'm sorry.
pretty scary. But it's funny because this Department of Justice guy, right, who you're talking about, he shows up and he tries to strong arm his way into Westworld, and then like Charloris puts flies into him, and then like later on there's the vice president, and I think they replace him with a robot body is my guess.
Probably because he isn't like freaking out and begging for death.
That's right. And then at the very end of the episode, we see William like acknowledge the Department of Justice guy and the vice president. And the vice president looks like a normal dude. And the Department of Justice guy looks like a zombie. right?
Oh, I didn't notice the Department of Justice guy there at the end.
Yeah, I think he's standing next to him completely, like, with a no expression on his, like, expressionless face staring into the middle distance.
Oh, no.
And so it's like, if you have the flies going in you, you're basically, your personality is gone. But if you have the robot version, you're, like, a decent approximation. And I just felt like, man, that guy, the Department of Justice guy, not even worthy of robot version. You know, like, that's how low he was on the hierarchy, unfortunately. Anyway.
Now I feel bad for him.
Just some rant. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's doubly bad because not only are you basically dead from that point forward, but you don't even have the dignity of having a robot body, you know? Like, anyway. Okay, we spent too long talking about this. So anyway, she says, you got to go see this opera. So they go see this opera. Somehow they acquire the clothes to go see the opera. They look awesome. And then you find out that the opera is actually, you know, a transportation to go to another park. And, you know, I didn't know where we were going. I thought it was actually maybe we're going back to Westworld, which would have been awesome. Going back to the park, and it would have been cool to see how that all happened. We see New Clementine kind of introduce them to things. And in the show notes, you made an observation that I also made, which is, it seems as though Maeve did a Mission Impossible-esque thing where she created a reservation for her and Caleb out of thin air, right?
Yeah.
Because he's like, oh, I don't know what name the reservation's under. You'll have to help me with that, honey. And then she like theoretically like makes the reservation up on the spot. But then later on, there's a bizarre line where New Clementine says, everything is fit according to your sizes. And it's like, well, if she just maybe like they threw it together really quickly after she made the reservation for them. Like, what is... He's like, yes, there's a new reservation. They're like, oh, shoot. Like, he's a size 8, you know, like...
Or maybe Caleb genuinely didn't know whose name the reservation was under, and he's just awkward in social situations.
Maybe, yeah. It's very possible. It's very possible. So, whatever the case, like, they've been led back to this park, and... I mean... It's not super clear why they're back at the... Like, they're there... I watched the episode twice, and it's because Anastasia says, hey, you got to go... It's opening night. We got to go see Don Giovanni. And, like, I guess they figured out where Don Giovanni was and then went there, right? Like, that's kind of... But they're just following a lead, I guess is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. I assume William and or Charloris... programmed the host Anastasia, sorry, the real Anastasia. See, even I'm confused. Programmed her to say that. Mm-hmm. But did they know that that message would eventually go to Maeve? Because I know that, you know, they're looking for Maeve.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. It's like, it's confusing. It's like, even if they programmed him to say that or her to say that, like, how did they know that she would go at the right time? Because it feels like these reservations are for a specific day and time. Like, did they know that Maeve was going to kill the... It doesn't make any... You know, so whatever. I'm not going to think too hard about it because the show hasn't put too much work in explaining it. But suffice to say, they're chasing down a lead.
Yeah.
And that's the only reason why they're there at the new park, right?
And so. It did have me wondering, you know, when they first enter the opera house and see these empty seats and then take the record needle off and then... You know, go into like a secret cabin. Why all this obfuscation? It's just a party. And then the train starts moving and then you hear the Westworld theme kick in. I'm like, it's park time, baby. We're heading back.
Yeah, baby.
We are heading back.
Mm-hmm.
Those of you only listening on audio, you can't see me throw my hands up in the air in excitement, but I just did.
Not quite back to where we thought we were, to a new park. But before we get to that, we have to talk about one of the biggest reveals of the episode, which is that William is alive, right? William is alive. We last saw William's throat getting slit at the post-credit sequence of episode 3, leading many of us to conclude that he's probably dead. However, as I pointed out in our preview episode, you never actually see him expire. And so anything's possible. And he is wearing a suit that very conveniently covers up his neck, so you can't see his gigantic neck gash. But I like how I really enjoy thinking about how the conversations must have gone around William Sidon of like, and with Ed Harris. They're like, Ed Harris, we want to bring you back. And then he's like, okay, yeah, great, I'm back as a host. And he's like, yeah, yeah, but we also want to bring back the original human version of you. And he's like, oh, but didn't you remember I got my throat cut last episode? Oh, right. Shit. Okay, well, you're going to wear this full body suit that has all these cables on it. That's what they use to keep you alive. And he's like, really? Do I have to do that? And they're like, yes. And it looks really cool. And apparently, Charloris has an entire room dedicated to just keeping William alive. That's the whole... There's nothing else in that room except this really cool-looking chamber to keep William, you know, alive and kind of in that Vitruvian man pose. And as you heard... Yeah, go ahead.
I think Bio's remorse is definitely at the center of having this version of William here. And I think one of two things is going on. One, either the writers realized, oh, wait, we just killed off this main dude in a post-credit sequence. That's kind of anticlimactic. We had more to do with him. Let's bring him back. Mm-hmm. Or, and stick with me, because, you know, we don't see whether or not he has a neck gash, and he also doesn't have that facial scar anymore on his cheek. Charloris, you know, does kill William at the end of last season.
Yeah, and then his human body.
And then realizes, oh, I wanted to mess with him. I wanted to torture that guy. And then she creates another host, William, who she convinces is the real William, just so she can torture him.
So that's three possibilities, right? Yeah. This is the reanimated William from last season. Or actually two possibilities. And the other one is he is a host version of William and the real William actually did die last season. Both of them equally plausible, in my opinion. So, no comment on which one is actually true. So,
all we can agree on is that we like his Tron Legacy suit.
Indeed. Why did she bring him back? Unclear. Other than she said she wants to mess with him. She wants him to, you know, no one can win unless someone loses, and she wants him to lose. And I guess she wants him to experience, subjugation and torture and pain in the way that he inflicted on host people. But what's most interesting to me is Charloris says, quote, "I want my people to be able to grow, flourish, to find their own identities. I have plans for your kind." This is very much the plot line that I thought we would get in season 3 of Westworld, right? Mm-hmm. Which is Dolores breaks out of the park and is like, robots should have a place in the world and humans should be enslaved and so on. And that's what I thought season 3 would be about. But instead, season 3 was about Dolores freeing humans, right? And now it almost feels like they were like, oh, let's have a do-over on season 3. We're like, forget about everything that happened in season 3. This time it's about the robots really taking over, you know? Which I thought was kind of amusing. I mean, to be fair, it's a different version of Dolores, so it's not the same Dolores. But... it did feel kind of a reset to me and kind of more like a conventional path for this plotline to go down. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
And I will say what makes it fun is the fact that Tessa Thompson is so good in the role.
She's very good. Yeah, go ahead.
Whatever's happened in the last 7 years, and I know at the end of last season we see Charloris, you know, lose her family or Charlotte's family, and then it kind of, you know, it turns her extremely bitter. But yeah, she's really spiraled in the last 7 years. She is straight up sadistic, and I love it. And I only wish that, you know, the scene where I think it's Clementine who ties the Justice Department guy's throat to the car seat.
Mm-hmm.
I only wish that was her introduction this season, that was Charloris's introduction, rather than when she strolls in the Senator flashback in soft focus. Because you first see just her eyes in the car mirror, and it's so sinister. I love it.
Yeah. The way Charloris was lit in that scene, like from in the backseat of the car, and you could see kind of her outline of her face, incredibly good. I originally was not a great believer in Tessa Thompson in this role. I thought she was far too young for, I think she was like a board member or something when you're first introduced to her, and it just never struck me as right casting. But she's in her late 30s now, and I think she's crushing it in this role. Like, I think she's very good as Charloris and, you know, evil robot that wants to take over humanity. So, I mean, do you have any speculation on what her plan might be? I think it's all I got right now is fairly simple. She wants to subjugate humans by enslaving them with fly robots and then allow the actual robots to run free and roam about the planet as they wish. That's kind of all I got right now.
Yeah, in terms of the broad strokes, that seems to be the plan. How anything else factors into it, how, you know, the reopening of the box factors in, the buying of the Hoover Dam, how that factors in.
Yeah.
We have no idea at this point. So at least this episode gives us the broad parameters and then is going to color within existing lines rather than just creating bigger and bigger boxes. At least we have that.
Yeah. So William gives a speech and he drops some tantalizing clues about the universe during the speech at the end where he's introducing this new park, right? He says, nearly 150 years ago, we had our first great war and first pandemic. He is referring not to World War III and COVID, but I think to World War I and the flu of the Spanish flu, 1918 flu, right? Followed by the Roaring Twenties, which is also alluded to. So based off of that information, you believe that the show takes place in like 2060, 2070 timeframe, right?
Thereabouts. Which was kind of disappointing because I liked the fact that it was set in just the future, just some vague, nebulous future.
I wish William had said hundreds of years ago and didn't say like 150 years ago, right?
Yeah, because
it really like pinpoints it in time. And now you're thinking about like, wait, is that even possible to happen in the next 50 years? That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, because then that means that the young William scenes and the beginnings of Delos happen basically in our present.
Yeah. Which is like
maybe they could in the next few years, but I liked it when it was more ambiguous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But another theory: what if he was referring to COVID? What if he? What if whatever becomes World War III? You know, we sort of lose our sense of history, and history mm-hmm. is written, and then that starts to be referred to as the First World War, and it's 150 years from now. But then, like,
I don't think so.
I don't think so either, because I did initially think that for a second. But then the fact that, you know, they're recreating and re-entering a very specific, you know, era, the early 20th century, makes me think that, okay, they probably do remember some amount of history.
Yeah. So he then reveals the park, which is a version of Chicago in the early 1900s, right? Presumably, what, 1920s, 1930s, 1940s? Like, when are you thinking this is?
So I would say 20s or 30s. Chicago was just my guess, just because so much of it is associated.
The train says Chicago on it.
Was it? I missed that. All right, in that case, it is Chicago. I assume in the 1920s or 30s, because that's when you really had, you know, the rise of, you know, a lot of classic gangster movies. And that's where a lot of our understanding of that kind of imagery comes from. So it's basically some kind of mobster park. Although at the same time, and again, it's like 90s, 20s or 30s fashion. Even though William does refer to it as like recreating or re-entering some kind of golden age. But in the US, I know the golden age was like the 1950s or whatever it was.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about this. But, you know, he could have just been, it could just be a turn of phrase. So in all probability, you know, this is Scarface Land. Original Scarface, not Al Pacino Scarface.
Right. I guess I'm curious, what is the narrative function of putting us back in this park, right? Like, is it just like, here's a fun divergence? Remember in, I think, season two, there was an episode called Akane no Mai that took place in, I think, feudal Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And it that was a cool episode, but it ultimately didn't impact the long, like, the through line of the season that much. And I'm curious, like, is this one just is introducing this new park area? And it's super cool to see people reanimated, the production design, the Westworld theme song in old-timey instrumentation. Like, that's all really cool stuff.
Yeah.
But what is the narrative purpose of it? Like, is it just, here's an excuse for us to play dress up and do cool stuff in old timey world? Or is there going to be a specific reason why this period of time is important to this plot? I am curious. I don't know. And is he expecting that this will be a bigger draw than the other stuff? And if so, like, why would people be like, hey, I don't trust Westworld, the place where all the massacres happened, but I am going to go to Chicagoland in the golden era. You know, like, I don't understand, like, from a business perspective or from a narrative perspective for the show, like, where this is going at all. It looks cool, though. It's a cool reveal to end on.
Yeah.
But do you have any speculation or any thoughts on that front?
In the long run, I'm not entirely sure just yet. I think you're onto something with the whole thing of like, oh, let's play dress up. Because that is part of the fun of the show. But you did bring up an interesting point with the Feudal Japan episode, because even though in the long run that doesn't really amount to much, it does serve an interesting temporary narrative function, isolated from everything else, because the stories you see unfold in that, you know, I guess samurai movie-inspired park are the same as the stories unfolding in Westworld, which kind of comments on the way Westerns and samurai films, you know, seem to influence each other over time. And,
yeah, that was cool. That was cool.
Yeah. And I think there is also some level of parallel here, because if this is the 1920s, if this is, you know, that would be during Prohibition, right, in the U.S. And you almost have a parallel there, because William is, by setting up this park, is doing something that is essentially outlawed by the government. So, you know, kind of breaking the rules of this prohibition on setting up Westworld. And it's good that we finally have an answer as to what he's trying to do throughout the episode, because I also watched it twice. And until we get this answer at the end that, oh, he's opening up parks, every scene is just, you know, talking around the point. Oh, will you make an exception? Will you give me a call? Will you listen to me? It's like, what are you talking about? What are we supposed to be invested in here? Although, to go back a few scenes, it is really funny that the vice president basically shits his pants when William makes his third hole in one on the golf course, because that's when he realizes he's a host.
Yeah, yeah.
Too good at golf.
That was cool. So I think we're wrapping up. We've already talked about some of the questions we have. I'm curious, like, you know, hopefully Teddy's going to get back into the mix next week, and we're going to figure out what's going on with Christina soon.
I think the show really needs to answer one vital question if it wants to keep its core audience hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Is Stubbs in the dub?
I think that's an apt question. You know, I feel like I might have heard that before, but maybe it's the first time you're bringing it up. Any other observations? There is one observation I wanted to make. I was going to call out what you said too about the hole in one. Like, that's a cool way to reveal that a character is a robot. Like, I like that a lot. The other thing I wanted to mention is there was you pointed out in the show notes about, like, them signing off their privacy rights, you know, agreeing to the terms of service, which is like, oh, still got those TOS that they got to agree to. It's probably harvesting, you know, way more data than Facebook has on us. But, you know, good to know. Another thing I wanted to point out that I enjoyed from this episode is Clementine from Dell is just straight up railroading the Department of Justice guy, which kind of is a vivid depiction of the idea of CEOs in some ways being more powerful than government agents. Like, that's the vision that this imagines, the future that this imagines is like,
yeah,
what if CEOs could just say, like, you know, F off if you're somebody from the government. And it's not inconceivable, based on the direction our society's headed, that would be the case. So,
and this is despite the fact that the Justice Department guy cites his reason for showing up as a potential national security threat.
Right. What was that about, by the way?
I assume it's just, oh, you know, opening up another Westworld park will lead to more, you know, robot massacres, I guess.
I thought it was they've gotten wind that the Delos is slowly replacing government agents with hosts, you know, and they're like, you must be stopped. But
could be that.
I guess that hasn't really happened until this episode, you know, right? I mean, you know, the guy says there's 249 of them out there, right? So what do they do? Are they just chilling, or are they, like, out there actively replacing people already, you know? Who knows? So, all right. Well, I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode, right, Siddhant? Anything else?
I think that's about it.
All right. If you want to listen to our Decoding Westworld Extra, be sure to check out patreon.com/DaveChen. Find more episodes of this podcast at decodingwestworld.com. Email us at decodingwestworld@gmail.com. We'll be back next week with another recap of Westworld.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.